We are the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short. And this is ACAM Learn.
Welcome to Mind the Kids, a podcast series dedicated to exploring the latest advancements in child and adolescent mental health, research and practice. I'm Clara, an academic clinical fellow in child psychiatry, and I'm passionate about understanding and addressing the diverse mental health challenges faced by young people globally. In this series, I will be joined by renowned researchers and clinicians worldwide to discuss their cutting-edge research, their innovative interventions, and best practices in child and adolescent mental health. So today, I have the pleasure of receiving Professor Nathalie Auger from the University of Montreal and Professor Howard Steiger from McGill University. And we will be discussing their paper, Maternal Anorexia Nervosa and Risk of Mental and Neurodevelopmental Morbidity in Offspring, that was published in the Child and Adolescent Mental Health Journal. So it's an honor to have you both here, Nathalie and Howard. And I wanted to start by saying that we know that anorexia nervosa is increasingly prevalent among women of reproductive age. And in your study, you take a really important perspective. So you look at outcomes in the offspring of these women using a very large cohort of over 1 million people, which is super exciting from an epidemiological perspective. So to start off, I wanted to ask you, what was the key question or knowledge gap that you were hoping to address with this study?
Mm-hmm. That's an excellent question. Thank you so much for asking it. We have a research program in our institution essentially looking at the outcomes of pregnancy and issues surrounding the health of children and childhood and adolescence. One of those things is essentially the mental health of mothers, how mothers' mental health influences child's rearing and so on at the population level. What we found looking at the literature was that there didn't seem to be much information out there on how anorexia comprehensively was associated with the outcomes of children later on in life. That's why we carried out this study. We wanted to see if we could tap our data to look more closely at all the different kinds of outcomes that could be linked with a mother's anorexia status.
Do you want to add anything, Professor Steiger?
Yeah. I think what's important about this study, too, is it increasingly we become aware that anorexia nervosa, of course, has a sociocultural basis and it can be influenced by familial factors, but it also has very strong biology and association with many other things that are quite far removed from eating. And so examining these sort of associations and the transmission of not only eating disorders, but mental health problems and attentional problems and neurodevelopmental problems really helps inform our understanding of what this disorder really is about. In current thinking, most experts in eating disorders understand anorexia nervosa to be, in fact, a metabo-psychiatric problem that has a large genetic component as well. And so I think the study by Nathalie's group really points in many ways to the way in which, you know, yes, perhaps we're talking about some influences of a psychosocial nature, mothers transmitting vulnerability and that through those pathways to children, but also likelihood of biological connections that are very important to understand.
Absolutely. And you mentioned the metabolic component, and it's not the focus of the discussion today, but I know there is another really interesting paper by both of you and your team looking at gastrointestinal outcomes, I believe, gastrointestinal problems in the offspring of mothers with anorexia, using, I think, the same cohort. And I think it's just really interesting because your group is really advancing our knowledge that actually the outcomes we see in patients and in their offspring is not just about the mental health or the behavior, as you said. It's about much more than that. So basically, we were talking about cohort studies before, and I know that there are other cohort studies also looking at maternal anorexia and offspring outcomes. One inclusive was using a UK cohort, but your study really stands out because, as you said, it is really comprehensive, and you are able to look and to follow up those children for a very extensive period of time. And you also include neurodevelopmental outcomes. So what would you say are the main headline findings, and were there any results that particularly surprised you?
Yes, another very good question. I'm not sure how you felt, Howard, but I was particularly impressed by the substance-related outcomes in the kids, like the especially neonatal abstinence syndrome and the childhood poisonings, where we weren't expecting those kinds of findings as much. We weren't expecting that we'd see such a strong association with neonatal abstinence syndrome. So that happens when at birth of the child and in those first few months, the child goes into withdrawal. We usually often don't know that the mother was taking substances, but it occurs because of the withdrawal of those substances after the delivery of the child, can be discovered incidentally and reflects either an unreported or unknown substance use disorder in the mother. Same thing with childhood poisonings, where unexpectedly there were a lot of poisonings in the child, suggesting that there's substances lying around in the house that the child is kind of accidentally ingesting and leading to these requirements to go to the hospital and be seen for the child. I was particularly surprised by that because those were substance use disorders in the mother that coincided with anorexia nervosa and were not detected. They only came to light when we saw the effect on the child, either at birth or in childhood. I thought that was particularly important and unrecognized.
Yeah, I think that that is really an interesting kind of association to identify. I guess the stereotype of people who have anorexia nervosa is people who are very rule-governed, perfectionistic, kind of over-controlled. And that image doesn't include often the reality, which is that many variations on anorexia nervosa include people who are highly dysregulated, impulsive, maybe a little bit more prone to being substance users and that sort of a thing. And so, yeah, it was a bit of a surprising finding for me too, but I guess as you're pointing out, Natalie, it really highlights the importance to consider detecting those kinds of things in clinical work. Also, I guess there's another reality. I mean, not to try to, you know, malign or blame people who have anorexia nervosa, but suffering a severe eating disorder means people are very overly absorbed in the problems of managing eating and not eating and the consequences of starvation. And I think it is not unlikely then that we're talking about mothers who at times may be so distracted or so kind of caught up in the realities of the disorder that they may not always be attentive to things like stuff that's left around that their kids might be, consuming and so on. So, you know, important stuff. I also thought it was really fascinating to see how clearly the results showed not only a kind of mother-child transmission of anorexia nervosa, but of things that are very frequently concurrent with anorexia nervosa that people don't always consider or aren't always aware of, such as the neurodevelopmental angle. The results showed it wasn't so much autism, but I guess probably much more attentional problems and things like that. There is a very clear clinical connection, comorbidity between anorexia nervosa and attentional problems. Some of the substrate would be common neurobiology, dopamine-related systems, for example, that are involved in both anorexia nervosa and attention deficit disorder, things like that. And so that was pretty striking as well.
Yeah. There were so many interesting findings. Speaking of the maternal transmission that you just mentioned, Howard, one of the findings that really stood out to me was the strong association that you found between anorexia nervosa and the risk of anorexia nervosa in offspring, and particularly hospitalization. I think I remember it was quite a large hazard ratio. And And I think this question also applies to the other findings you just mentioned, because we know, as you said in the beginning, Howard, that there is a really strong genetic component to anorexia nervosa. But what I'm also wondering is about the role of the environment, in the sense that growing up with a parent who is unwell and, you know, potentially being exposed to certain behaviors or attitudes around food. And equally, you just mentioned, for example, the inattention. And we know that ADHD, for example, has a very strong neurobiological basis. But I also wonder if the fact that, you know, if your parent has ADHD and you're constantly being exposed, you know, to disorganized behavior, or if that's your reference level, I wonder, how do you make sense of that balance between genetic and environmental influences in your findings, considering that we're talking about outcomes really later on in life? I think you followed up the kids up to the age of 17, if I'm correct.
Well, actually, we're looking at kids who were hospitalized up to the age of 17, right? Because don't forget, the findings are really based on a database that reflects hospitalization for anorexia nervosa in the public record. Of course, that brings things close to what has been a real interest of mine as a clinician and scientist researcher throughout my career, which is epigenetics. You know, the science about how the environment turns on or turns off genetic susceptibilities. And in anorexia nervosa is a fascinating kind of example of the ways in which we have clear heredity, but then an environment has to activate vulnerability. For example, you can't develop anorexia nervosa without doing too much calorie restriction or too much dieting. So you need an environment that, if nothing else, induces people to feel that they're overweight and feel that they should be restricting food intake. And we have some fascinating findings that really talk about the way in which nutritional factors directly can be involved in activating genetic susceptibilities. You know, one of our recent studies points to not only the way in which genes that are involved in brain function or that would be influential over mental health can be turned on by malnutrition. We were studying B12 deficiencies and things like that, but also genes related to the metabolic side of things, insulin function, and other stuff. But so to get more back directly to your question, Clara, eating disorders, it's very difficult to know how to disentangle that, both in our data in this study, but in all areas, to really try to tease out the ways in which what is very likely is that both psychosocial influences and genetic influences are involved. Kids with anorexia nervosa classically are people who worry about others' welfare to the neglect of their own, of satisfying their own needs sometimes. You know, in psychodynamic lore, we talk about parentified children who have to worry about their parents, you know, instead of worrying about themselves sometimes. And maybe there is some aspect of this which might be about a mom who has attention deficit disorder and needs to be kind of organized by the child in some ways. So that could be one factor, but I think we also want to strongly consider, you know, it's not bad moms and it's not bad parenting that causes eating disorders. These are disorders that have a really clear basis in real physical susceptibility that then gets turned on by real environmental exposures. You know, some of them are stresses during development, but for sure, the ultimate one is the stress of being malnourished or calorie, involved in, you know, subject to marked calorie restriction. So I don't know, Natalie, if you have thoughts on how to disentangle those things, but, you know, clearly any kind of, you know, research always has to sort of bear in mind the reality that we're really talking about a biopsychosocial phenomenon that has a biology and an environmental context.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think it's a general issue in when you're working with large data sets and doing epidemiological analysis, it's hard to address, like, the cause. What is the underlying factor? Is it biological factors, environmental factors, genetic factors? Those things are hard to disentangle. Sometimes there are some methods that can be used like sibling and a families working with the family unit to try to control for or those kind of environmental influences within the family, genetic factors within the family. In this particular study, we didn't use that approach. We were looking mother-child, so there was no siblings as controls. But definitely, you know, it's another research. I consider it as another research question or the next step. What is the next thing that a researcher sure could look at, which is to try to disentangle using some kind of different methods that are out there? Something for the future, I'd say.
You know, it's very, as Natalie's saying, very difficult to devise methodologies that separate these things. But, you know, maybe we can infer some things, even just by sort of patterns that are found in the data. I found what was very interesting was the finding that suggested that you had different effects whether the mom was hospitalized for her anorexia nervosa while pregnant or subsequently to or prior to. One of the things that I'm thinking of as I'm saying this is that the moms who were hospitalized while pregnant tended to be associated with mental health outcomes in the offspring. Makes me think of numerous studies that talk about maternal stress during pregnancy as being a correlate or an antecedent to mental health outcomes or negative mental health outcomes in kids. We have a study that looked at the outcome for kids whose moms were pregnant with them during a very famous ice storm that happened in 1998 in Quebec. It was considered Canada's worst natural disaster. And so, although it's a bit weird to think in terms of the effect of ice storms on anorexia, you know, we were talking about moms who lived a horrible environmental stress. And strangely enough, those kids whose moms were exposed to marked environmental stress during pregnancy have a higher risk of anorexia, of eating disorder related symptoms when they became adolescents, you know, many years later. Again, you know, sort of suggested the effect of moms, perhaps, you know, moms' stress levels during pregnancy. Now, clearly, moms who are hospitalized for anorexia nervosa while they're pregnant, you know, not only are they actively malnourished, but they're clearly undergoing a high level of distress. And so, you know, these are important factors to bear in mind. Even before people are born, you know, the risk for developing things like eating disorders is kind of being prepared.
I was going to say that it's really fascinating to think that even before someone is born, there are so many factors. And I'm not in obstetrics and gynecological research, but I know that is also a very trending area of research right now, like the intrauterine environment and all those influences in the development of the child. And yeah, the ice storm study, I'm going to read that one. I didn't know about that one. That's really interesting.
Yeah, if I can say as a clinician, I think it's really important because if there's one thing that, there's huge stigma attached to eating disorders. If there's one thing that people who have eating disorders experience strongly, it's shame. You know, and same for moms of kids or parents of kids who've developed eating disorders. And these kinds of findings, you know, demonstrate that it's not so simple as all that, that there's a lot of kind of biology that's acting even before you're born. You don't develop an eating disorder because of moral weakness. You know, you develop it because of real physical susceptibilities that get turned on by real environmental exposures that are active throughout one's lifespan, even prior to one's lifespan, you know, prenatally.
100%. And I think another element also to add and to link with my next question is also like we know people have access to treatment at different times in their lives and some people struggle to have access to treatment. And a really interesting finding of your study for me was the timing of the maternal anorexia that mattered. So you found that anorexia treated in later adolescence or adulthood was actually associated with increased risk in offspring, but actually anorexia before the age of 15 was not associated with increased risk. And I was going to ask both of you, but maybe Howard, you can contribute with your vast clinician experience if that aligns with what we understand clinically about anorexia, or if that finding, you know, raises new questions, because in my mind, I thought that, you know, someone who may have anorexia earlier in life, you know, they might have a more serious course of illness. But that was just my, just musing.
Yeah, I really scratched my head around that finding. I'm not sure how to interpret it. I hope Natalie has a better interpretation than I'll have. But the thoughts that occurred to me were that, you know, I mean, we know clinically that early, you know, forms of anorexia that we see early in adolescence tend to be much more treatable. They tend to be a little more likely to be transient problems or problems that can be resolved quickly clinically, whereas eating disorders that, you know, persisted later into the life cycle tend to be a little stickier or more. So maybe, you know, one possibility is we're talking about really milder forms of eating disorders that were present in these moms who were hospitalized early on. That's one idea. I mean, I suppose another one is that she was treated early, maybe she was recovered before she gave birth. And so the consequences of an active eating disorder during gestation wouldn't have been active, that sort of thing. Or maybe mom's adjustment was better by the time the kid was born.
Yeah, I had similar thoughts that younger girls with anorexia, it was a different process as opposed to adult women with anorexia, where the underlying, you know, driver might be a bit different. And I don't know the extent to which social media, you know, young kids and social media are, I don't know if there's the element of that in the disease. I felt like there was also another interesting finding, which was that women who had been treated had shorter treatment stays for anorexia nervosa, who may have been less receptive to treatment, at checking out of the hospital early and so on. Those ones were also having more of those kinds of outcomes in their kids later on. I felt like just under treatment or the early treatment of those 15-year-olds, the threshold might be lower also in hospitals. Clinicians might admit children more easily when they're very young, give them necessary treatment early on in life, that those factors are actually a good thing. Treating anorexia nervosa seemed like a good thing for her later children.
Yeah, I guess that also points, if we want to think even in terms of sort of epigenetic factors, then, you know, we might be thinking about, you know, moms who gave birth later to their children have a greater accumulation, perhaps, of those kinds of mechanisms that might be being transmitted to the fetus epigenetically. You know, so, you know, who knows? But these are all issues for speculation and really challenging to try to unravel.
And speaking of challenges, Natalie, you touched on that earlier a little bit when you spoke about sibling analysis. But one of the outcomes your study also looks at is at neurodevelopmental outcomes. And we know that those tend to cluster in families. So I was going to ask, how did you account for that in your analysis, and how confident you are that the associations you found regarding the neurodevelopmental outcomes specifically, they're just not reflecting broader familial risk?
I see. That's another really good question. I see all these issues as interconnected. Another question where we can't answer using the kind of data we have. And so it's, I guess, a little bit disappointing where the answer is, again, I don't know. But I think that they're all important issues for the next phase of research. Other researchers that may have different kinds of data, different kinds of details in their data sets, to address this kind of like, what is the underlying cause? Is it maternal anorexia nervosa that's causing the problem? Or is it other underlying or surrounding issues in her environment that are driving the other kinds of less expected outcomes, like the neurodevelopment?
No, it's not a disappointing answer at all. And I think that actually, it's really interesting when you think about, you know, methods that you can use to kind of try to disentangle those associations. And as Howard mentioned, like, what is epigenetics, and you know, what is, like, what is really driving that effect? Is it the epigenetics? Is it the genetics? Is it, as you said, the environment that is triggering that genetic vulnerability? And I think that really matters, right, when we think about what interventions we can use from those findings.
Yeah, also, I think Natalie's on the right idea when she says these things are interconnected. And so, you know, it's I think almost invariably true in all kinds of studies, whether they be clinical studies, population level, whatever, is that we can't disentangle these things easily. And it's probably because they don't disentangle. You know, eating disorders are not just about eating. You know, they represent a kind of, you know, multidimensional convergence of various kinds of vulnerabilities, some of which include attentional problems, personality traits, metabolic traits, other stuff like that. So maybe it, well, I mean, this is speculative rather than based on the data, I suppose. But my bet, if I had to bet, would be that they're part of the same vulnerability that's being transmitted. You know,
that's a really interesting take. And I think thinking about implications for clinical practice, and yeah, based also on your knowledge as like clinicians and epidemiologists, what do you see as the main implications of your findings for supporting women with a current or past history of anorexia who are maybe thinking about having children and are worried about their reproductive future?
Mm-hmm. Yes. I think on the Dana analysis, and what we saw or see in the data is that eating disorders, they're not something that's affecting only you, and that you know, there is a connection with your future descendants, your future families, and that they should be treated, not ignored, not let to become more severe, but treated early on to the extent that's possible. And that this early treatment is not only beneficial for you, but your own children as well. That's the main message, the key takeaway that we sensed in the data itself.
Yeah, I guess they point also to how important it is for people to be well-informed and well-educated about the realities of some of these kinds of problems. Again, it, you know, it's not a shameful thing to have anorexia nervosa. It's something that exists for real reasons, and people who have it need to know that it may have consequences for their own future adjustments and for the adjustments of their kids and so on. However, you know, it's funny, probably a million times I've been asked by somebody who has an eating disorder, like, do I have to worry about this? Am I going to transmit it to my children? You know, what's really important there is epigenetic counseling. My answer to that one is really, you know what? Genes are innocent until the environment turns them to a life of crime, you know? And so, you know, don't think that just because you carry genes that could be associated with a certain vulnerability, that means necessarily your kids are going to have this problem. There's a lot of influences that will either protect or accentuate risk. And that's one of the reasons also to be careful to make sure you know, favor their development, but that there's nothing so determinant that means, you know, you have to feel that you're carrying some kind of awful legacy that you're going to pass on.
And I think that perspective that both of you brought, but that perspective about risk not being a sentence, but something that actually can be modulated when we speak about eating disorders, but mental health disorders more broadly, is so important, because it's something people really care about, as you said, like, oftentimes patients ask, oh, but will I pass this on to my children? And actually the answer is much more complex and much more nuanced. And also just to highlight, because I know sometimes we have lots of people with lived experience listening to this podcast. Just to highlight, I thought that was like a really hopeful finding about how if you actually are treated earlier before the age of 15, that was associated with much better outcomes for offspring So to wrap up, looking ahead, if each of you could highlight one area of research you would really like to see developed further in this field, and especially using, you know, large population cohorts that we now have available, what would it be?
I don't have a necessarily correct answer, but in my mind, I always wonder about men with eating disorders, how that can influence the family and outcomes of their children as well. They aren't pregnant, obviously, but I feel like that might be an under-addressed issue that could potentially be important as the mother. So I feel like that's something that could receive more attention in future research.
Yeah, on that note, in fact, you know, we have to be careful about not doing mom blaming. You know, dads matter too. And you know, even in an epigenetic sense, you know, there's a lot of data to suggest that dads transmit susceptibilities through the sperm line in a way that mean they're involved in these things too. But now, I guess my answer to your question, Clara, is going to be sort of obvious and predictable because of my clear interest in gene-environment interactions and things. I think that, like, Natalie, you have to get into population-level studies that look at the influence of environmental impacts on people who have certain kinds of susceptibilities. And, you know, also, I think I don't know if those data can even be obtained. It seems to me that what's really a really key area that we have to explore in the area of eating disorders, you know, among some people, not everybody, but there's a subset of people who go on to have very long-standing eating disorders that can sometimes persist throughout one's lifespan. And so, and I'm pretty convinced that the, you know, people who were struggling to think, what new treatments can we offer that will prevent these things or help these people recover? And I have a feeling it's almost maybe naive to think it's going to be some new treatment rather than thinking about the trajectory of use of the treatments that we already have, you know, and whether we can study the ways in which sometimes it's because people had a treatment that was time limited and then a huge gap before they received any further care, or weren't able to access the right level of care at the right time. And so I think it's really important if we can do that at a sort of more population level and really study the trajectories through which people go in treatment, you know, bingo, I think that might, you know, reveal a lot of very important things about how to help people better.
That's, I mean, I could stay here all day talking about this just because in the UK right now, there is a really big debate on assisted dieting. And some people who, you know, have longstanding eating disorders, mainly anorexia, have become a part of this debate. And I think, and there's a lot of like conflicting views because lots of people share, and myself included, share your view, Professor Steiger, that, you know, eating disorders are definitely not terminal illnesses. And actually, when we look at these people with really long-standing eating disorders, it's more, I think, about asking what happened. And often as well, like, there are other comorbidities involved. And as you said, like, oftentimes it's just that they weren't treated for long enough. But I understand it's a challenge and it is a very contentious issue. But it would be really interesting if you could look at it with large populational data sets. It would be really interesting in looking at outpatient outcomes as well, just because when we look at inpatient outcomes, oftentimes there is the selection of bias that we are selecting for the most severe cases, right? But actually what happens, you know, with people who maybe received brief psychosocial interventions and actually never engaged with services anymore. But that's just me musing. I just wanted to say a huge thank you to both of you. This has been so interesting, and to be able to discuss the findings of your paper in more detail and to hear from you both. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you. I'm here as well. It was a pleasure to be with you.